Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Our very special guest today is a percussionist, musician extraordinaire. It's always a pleasure to speak to someone who does what he does very well, Mr. Juma Sultan. How are you, Mr. Sultan? How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great today.
50 years in music, I have to believe you've seen a little bit of everything. And
pretty much it. Yeah. There's not much that I haven't seen. The only thing that I haven't seen is a lot of the new stuff that's going on these days.
Yeah.
I've seen enough to know that I don't need to see too much more. Just see a change with the things that are happening now.
What are you listening to? What do you listen to yourself?
Well, I still, you know, to be honest with you, I still draw on the people that came before me, all the, you know, all the other, you know, musicians, you know, because, you know, primarily I came through as a jazz musician, and I just happened to play rock and roll, R&B, gospel, you know, African music, you know, just different, you know, just a whole diaspora of what they call jazz here in America, you know, because it all comes from Phil Hollers through after the Emancipation, you know, the Revolution with all the Dixieland and jazz, and then you have the other musicians, you know, that came through with the blues and other aspects of the music, but it's all basically the same to me. But what I listen to these days is I listen to all the mainly the older guys that came before us.
Now,
you know,
let's
John. You know, I primarily really, really love jazz more than rock and roll, and I listen to everybody because I play with so many diverse musicians. You know, right now
that's putting it mildly. Diverse musicians. I mean, you've done the whole spectrum. It's really an amazing career. You're a very talented guy, and I was just telling my producer, it's always a pleasure to talk to somebody with that much talent. You're a very, very talented guy. I'm going to get into a little bit of some of the, you know, especially a particular famous show that I'm sure you're sick of hearing about at this point. But let's do a little history on Juma Sultan. And if you're just tuning in, this is Frank McKay, and Juma Sultan is my guest. You were born in Monrovia, California. Is that right?
That is correct. That is correct.
And now you grew up in or around that area?
I grew up in the Monrovia, California, is in Los Angeles County, and I grew up there up until probably around my 20 years. I grew up there. I went to City College. I went to UCLA as an art major. Moved to Topanga Canyon, and that's where I basically, started a professional music career. Prior to that, you know, I played music all my life. I played trombone in the third grade and sousaphone in high school. And then when I was in college, I had an interest in folk music. So I, when I was at Pasadena City College, I started getting into folk music. You know, Lead Belly, I used to sing, play guitar and sing the blues.
So, that's interesting.
You know, during that period.
Yeah, I mean, there was, thank God, somebody went around to record Lead Belly, and I forget the gentleman's name.
Oh yeah, Lead Belly, Son House, and there was a lot of local guys, Ronnie Cherry and Sonny McGee, you know, even in the beginning, you know, when Taj Mahal wasn't known, you know, we were at the Fifth Estate and different clubs in Venice, I'm old enough where I spanned the Beat Generation and to the hippie, you know, that's
right.
Really where I started, you know.
Now, what did your parents do? Were either of them musicians?
My father, he sang. I have very talented sisters and brothers that can really sing. And I used to sing in doo-wop. And, at a certain time, like right now, my voice is a baritone. But I used to be a very good bassist, natural bass. And, in doo-wop bands, you know, in the early 50s.
Out here on the I'm on the East Coast, and I'm in I think you are too at this point, right?
Likewise.
You're,
I'm up in Woodstock proper in the upstate New York, beautiful Catskill Mountains.
Yeah, it is beautiful up there, no question. But we always hear about the romance of Dion and the Belmonts being in the Bronx and singing on the street corners, or people in Philadelphia sitting around the fire buckets. I can't imagine it was the same feel in Los Angeles. But what kind of doo-wop scene did they have then?
Oh, they had so many different bands, at that time, and as every area, you focus on the local talent, you appreciate everyone, because during those doo-wop days, you had that, but you also had musical groups, just all the various musical groups that sang in the days I was raised on what they call race music, okay. At that time, all the way from, all the old guys, Caldonia, all the other things that my parents, listened to and other people listened to in the areas, all the way up through so-called, was more of a R&B, rhythm and blues,
Ray Charles and things,
All of them.
Yeah.
Ray Charles and those who preceded Ray Charles, they were still, when you get down to, the early 40s, Open the Door, Richard, Caldonia, all those songs, all those old tunes that were, you can only get in the barbershop or at other restaurants and things of that nature. They weren't selling them on, in record stores and things of that nature.
When you got out of college, what was your first steady gig as a musician? Go ahead.
My first steady gig as a musician was in Haight-Ashbury.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a steady gig, because I've been playing percussion since I was nine years old, but I'm really my main instrument for many years was upright bass. Mm. And I still play upright bass.
See, I wasn't aware of that. Jeez. Why? Oh. I think we're so we have that picture in our minds of Woodstock, and you closed out with Jimi Hendrix, and that was the famed show I mentioned, and you played percussion. And it was the Band of Gypsies, I guess it was called at the time.
No. See, people get that wrong.
Go ahead. What is it?
The Gypsy Sons and Rainbows.
There we go.
That was the band in between the Jimi Hendrix Experience and the Band of Gypsies.
Now,
the band that was at Woodstock was the band that the management did not want to have. Okay, basically. And that was the Gypsy Sons and Rainbows. And so if you do a little research in history, you'll see that Jimmy announced, this is a Gypsy Sons and Rainbows, and we only had about 2 months living together up here prior to that festival, where we were pulling a band together to perform at the Woodstock Festival. And that was the Gypsy Sons and Rainbows. That's what he called it.
It's such a historical, iconic performance that you guys had performed there, and it was just an amazing moment in time. But if you look at the crowd, it was sparse compared to what it was. It was the last day. I mean, people were breaking down. What was the scene like there? I mean, did you...
Well, the scene like was seen there. We arrived there about 10 o'clock the night before we performed, and we were supposed to go on after Sly and the Family Stone around midnight and close it. They were like 6 or 7 hours behind schedule.
Yeah.
And so we didn't perform until the early morning. And all those people that were there for 3 days, the crowd did start dwindling,
Yeah.
But when we arrived, it was nothing but a sea of people.
Was there any talk about going on no matter what, how late that night? Was there either pressure being put on you, or were you internally discussing?
No, the only pressure that was put on is that we showed and we were ready to play, and we had to wait. that was the only pressure.
Yeah.
Is wait until all the other bands that, came before us. And the rest of it, and then we waited actually all night long, until the sun was coming up, in the morning.
What had you been hearing? What had you been hearing about the scene there? I guess almost like a state of emergency.
I heard a lot about it, and we at first they were going to helicopter us in, but then they found back roads to get us in, And so I was very familiar with the site because I was out there when it was in its construction, because I was good friends with Michael Lang and the people that organized it.
Mm. And Michael Lang, we've had him on the show, and I always ask him the same. Well, I'm asking him the same questions that I'm asking you about this, and it's just it's history. I mean, you were a part, a huge part of history, and I have to believe when you came there, there had to be some jitters, right? There had to be some nerves. You didn't know what you were walking into.
I wasn't jittery. There were some guys that were jittery, because when we got there, it was nighttime, and as far as you could see, all you could see are little lights as far as the eye could see up over the horizon, and little campfires, lights and different things, and you knew that all the people were there. You couldn't really see any faces because it was dark.
Mm.
But you could see a sea of people. That's what I call it, a sea of people. That's what it looked like to me.
If you're just joining us, I want to remind everyone, this is Frank McKay, and I have the privilege to speak to Juma Sultan, who is just an extraordinary musician. He's had a 50-year career and counting. It's probably more than 50 years, right, that you've been...
Yeah, at this point. Around 19, I started... playing guitar and playing out, to various audience.
Now, how did you come across, or who introduced you to Jimi Hendrix?
Well, I met Hendrix, Jimi Hendrix and they're now called the Aline Brothers, but Arthur and Albert, that were good friends with Jimmy in Harlem and supported. And then, I was always playing percussion, like in, Washington Square. Even when I was in San Francisco, I was playing, drums and percussion, African percussion, but also along with bass with that. And Hendrix, I first met Hendrix in Harlem, and when he was, after his tour with Little Richard and the Isley Brothers and things of that nature, and he was trying to strike out on his own, and he was pretty much hand to mouth, like most of the musicians that existed in New York, didn't have a steady gig. I had a chance to see him at, the Cheetah Club with Curtis Knight and, what's his name, the horn player. I'm trying to think. Anyway, the name will come to me.
Yeah.
Right.
What was your initial impression? Did you have the feeling that, hey, this guy is exceptional, this guy is going to change at least rock music?
I didn't have that impression, but I knew that he was reaching for higher ground because at that time when I came to New York, I was basically playing more of the new music and the avant-garde myself. I had gone through the bebop and things of those era, of that era, and I was playing more of the avant-garde type music, and he caught my ear. I always appreciated him, even down in the village when he had his Jimmy James and the Flames and things. But we never had played together, he and I.
Was he? So, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, when he came back from England, I was teaching at an intermediate workshop up in Saugerties, which is a neighboring town to Woodstock.
Yeah.
And it was an intermediate workshop. And I was in town, and I ran into him, and he said, oh, yeah, this was after he became famous. And he said, oh, I know you. And we started talking. And said, yeah, I know who you are. And we started talking. And after that, he had already had, Are You Experienced. And I was familiar with his music from the San Francisco Hey Dashbury days, because I was out there. I was out there at that time. And I appreciated what he called sounds, because not only did he play tunes, but he had a lot of sounds that he brought to them.
Now, when you say sounds that were coming out of the guitar or electronic, you're talking about effects. Was he into effects?
He was totally into effects, but he was into what John Coltrane called sheets of sounds. Jimmy listened to everybody from Stravinsky, Beethoven. He listened to everybody, to Roland Kirk, to John Coltrane, to Olatunji. He listened to, and plus all the other, he appreciated all the other rock musicians that were there, because if you see when he was in England, not only did he jam and scare so many people with the music that he was creating, but he appreciated, you know, the sounds that were coming out of all the other rock and roll that was being created at that time.
Was he intrigued and interested in percussion? Did he ask you a lot of questions? And again, you're certainly...
No, because just like Richie Havens, Jimmy could play drums. He could play just about any instrument you put in front of him, naturally.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know what
he
played.
And also, if you listen to him, and you'll see that his rhythms were many of them were Afrocentric bass. And if you listen to the rhythms that he played on the guitar, and the things that he created that people are doing now, you know, just the different sounds that he was creating, it was commensurate with various rhythms. And this is why even at Woodstock he had two percussionists. He had a Latin percussionist, and I was playing more of an Afro fusion.
If you're just tuning in, this is Frank McKay, and more importantly, you listen to Juma Sultan, who is a musician extraordinaire, and he was among the last musicians to take the stage at the famed Woodstock Festival. And when you left that stage, did you have any idea that we would still be talking about it 40 years later, 45 years later?
No. To be straight up, no.
You didn't?
No idea. Yeah. No idea that at that time we were making history. We none of us had any idea. All we knew is that we were playing with somebody who was highly advanced in terms of his music, because what he did, he took the blues and opened the envelope for so many other variables and variation upon that particular style. But he's always was a, if you want to know, in my opinion, a consummate bluesman. And this is why he was able to play with all the various rhythm and blues, you know, in his early career.
Yeah,
as a
brothers.
Rhythm guitarist. But through that experience and being out there and also learning from others, he knew how to play all the things and all the stage persona. Not only was he a musician, but like Sammy Davis Jr., he was an entertainer, and that's what he did. And he just took it to another level.
He certainly did that. You know, it's a unique figure in the history of music, and whether rock music or any music. You know, I had the pleasure of speaking to John McLaughlin the other day, and we interviewed...
Oh, yeah. John would give you a very good insight because...
Amazing. Yeah, just,
they actually have played together.
Yeah, well, he has blown me away for years, John McLaughlin. Just, he's another one who has just this no barriers type of what type of music or what type of sounds he's coming across. And I always
great.
put you in that category as well. I mean, you have that. It's hard to pigeonhole what you do. I mean, you do a tremendous amount of styles, and you mentioned growing up what you were listening to, and you learned from the people that came before you. I think it's amazing.
Well, from the radio, early radio, you know, as you know, there was not a lot of rhythm and blues or even rock and roll on it until you know, guys like Elvis Presley and different people came through and the rockabilly sound. But prior to that sound, you know, the major thing that you listened to was country music, which is I call the cousin to the blues personally. You know, the country music.
Yeah.
With the lyrics and the style. You know, now they have modern country, but it's all basically the same. Just how you configure it.
If you're just tuning in, we have about a minute left with Juma Sultan, and this is Frank McKay. And in about a minute, can you give us an update on what you're doing, or maybe where we could follow you? Is there a website? Is there social media?
Well, I'm in the process of building a website. You can, the title is Juma Sultan .net, and on there is Juma Sultan, Jimi Hendrix percussionist. I also have a website at Clarkson University that will give you a more diverse area because it covers jazz It covers folk, it covers spiritual, it covers everything, and it's called JumasArchive.org. And from there, you can find your way around. But that's at Clarkson University. It's a collection. I received a grant from the National Endowment to do that about 7 years ago.
Just an amazing career, and it's still going. It's still going strong. Yes. You feel like you got a lot of years of music in you?
Oh, I still, you know, I'm going to be like so many others. If I go out, I just as soon go out on the bandstand.
Tremendous.
Performing.
So, Jumas.
Anyway, I'm working with many guys. I've been working with, doing work with Vinnie Martell, for instance. We do a lot of gigs together now. He's still a Vanilla Fudge. They just finished an album, and we have projects that we're working on. I work with T.M. Stevens, who work with everybody, you know.
He's been around many years.
You know, just so many. There's so many great artists that I've had the pleasure of being associated with and working with. So I stay pretty busy. So I mean, right now, there will be music, and also I want to let you know that Jimmy was so highly respected in the jazz community, if you ever get a chance, go on the line and there's a track called Shokan Sunrise. They gave Jimmy credit for all of the tunes, but about four of them, he's playing my music with my band called the Aboriginal Music Society. And you'll see the influence in people who said, I didn't know Jimmy could play this way, because he's playing like Wes Montgomery. He's doing all kind of other types of sounds. So that's what I would say. Anybody who's really a Hendrix aficionado would possibly want to look up that. So if you look up Jimi Hendrix and you look up Shokan Sunrise, you'll see an influence and also a direction that he was going in, because he was hearing so much. He wanted to do orchestra. So perhaps we can talk at another time. You said we only got a minute.
Yeah.
I cannot give you a summation in 1 minute.
Do you have time for another segment?
Sure. We can do another segment.
All right. We'll be back this with Jumer Sultan. I'd like to welcome everyone back to Breaking It Down. Our very special guest today is Jumer Sultan, and he is a musician extraordinaire. He's played with Jimi Hendrix, Vince Martell, a whole host of people that you could look and check into this man. He has been at it for 50 years and counting, and once again, it's always a pleasure to speak to someone who does what they do very, very well. Jumer, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, right before we took a break here, we got into, you started telling us and opening up a little bit about Jimi Hendrix playing like Wes Montgomery. Now that, even fans of Jimi Hendrix might not have heard any of that in his playing. I mean, they know him from his rock playing and obviously his more popular stuff. Where can you point us to? And you're
I can point you to some musical tracks, which I indicated. Shokan Sunrise, it's on web. Somebody's been bootlegging it out of Germany in various places since 1994, if I'm not mistaken. I've done my own research. But it's there, and it's music that if you want to hear Jimmy play some, other than music like Angel and Castle Made of Sand, the softer version, you know, everyone looked at him as just always playing wild, you know, but he had some very unique abilities, to where even he, in the jazz community, he earned the respect of jazz musicians who were much more studied than he was, but he had such a natural talent. As most of us might not know, but he didn't read music. He just played by ear.
Did you like the way, or do you like the way that his legacy is being carried on? I think it's Tina Hendrix,
well,
right?
No. Because I just have too much inside information, and I think that his legacy is also being stifled, because it doesn't show his all-around talent.
Why is that? Do you think there's so many people that just don't care about the depth of it, and they just want to see the flash, and they want to see rock, and maybe they don't
understand? No. It's all about the dollar, just like the management was in those days. The band that was at Woodstock, the management just wanted the million-dollar baby, I call it. Yeah. It was a million-dollar baby, and it was him, you know, Mitch and Noel, and that's what they wanted because that's what was making money commercially.
Yeah.
And so they did everything they could to kill that particular band, and that's how the Band of Gypsies came about. They just eliminated people, and Mitch had left a long time ago. He really didn't even want to play with the band, with the Gypsy Sons and Rainbows, because he didn't understand the direction that that Jimmy was going in terms of his music. And Jimmy wanted to just take time off and create new music. And they didn't want him to create any creative new music. They wanted him to continue on the path that he was doing and play all the old songs, Hey Joe, you know, and things of that nature that people were familiar with. And so the management did everything they could to crush that particular band. And some of it came out, you know, with The Cry of Love and once we got into Electric Lady Studio. But as you notice, even on those, he didn't have the full band. You know, I'm on about 12 of his posthumous recordings because he and I were not only friends, but we had a musical empathy.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that you show up on a lot of his more interesting music. Actually, I let me not be judgmental on it. It's
okay, but I showed up on, I mean, most of the albums that they produced after his death, I'm on. I was on maybe two prior to that. You know?
Now, how many albums could they come? I mean, is there still unreleased material of Jimi Hendrix? How much did he record?
Oh, they could. The way they're releasing it, they could do this for probably the next, I would predict, 4 or 5 years. Yes, they're still in their vaults. There are so many occasions because Jimmy played with so many people. And Jimmy used the studio to compose. And that's really what happened. So there's a lot of tracks out there that's never been heard. But should they be heard? Because, you know, for instance, I mentioned Chocan Sunrise. Well, one of the tracks on there is a tune called Sundance. It was my song, and it was a trio setting. And in the trio setting was a jazz drummer named Ali Abui. I was playing electric bass, and Jimmy was playing guitar. And it's only a nice, soft trio setting. And it was really a sweet, beautiful song called Sundance. And so, I mean, that's verifiable. That tune was copywritten in 1968, before we even met Jimmy. Before we even played with Jimmy, excuse me.
Let me just remind people that may just be tuning in that this is Frank McKay, and my special guest is Jumer Sultan. And he is a musician and, you know, percussionist and stand-up bassist and just musician all around that has become part of the Hendrix legacy and, you know, part of the living legacy. And I don't want to tell you, there's not many of you left that...
Well, there's three of us left.
Yeah,
Billy Cox,
right.
Gerardo Velez, and I. The rest of the people that regularly... was involved with Jimmy, except for people that came and go. You know, we're the only ones left.
Now, there's not many people like you can firsthand that could talk about him, and that's unique in this part of history because obviously there's no one that could talk to Beethoven, or there's no one that could talk to Mozart. You know, so we've come down to our great musicians, and you know, and again, the reason we focus on rock musicians is because rock musicians sold, and they sold millions of records. And as I mentioned, I mean, I've got the greatest respect in the world for John McLaughlin, and the guy's just an amazing.
Oh, with Mahavishnu and
amazing.
You know, just I mean, so many people drew off of Jimmy, and you know, standing on his shoulders to this time. And I mean, you know, he blew some of the some of the greatest musicians that were part of the whole creation of the rock, what we know as rock and roll today, out of England. You know, he blew them off the stage. He just they were in you know, Eric could tell you personally that he was amazed. You know, and I think he Bracken is one of the still living formidable musicians. you know, that had an acquaintance with Jimmy.
What do you think he would have done if he would have lived? Would he have?
It's hard to tell because of his I call it genius, you know, because of his abilities. It would be hard to tell because he was listening to another sphere of sound, you know, and he wanted he heard orchestrations, he heard so many things that he was never able to get to and to develop. So what he would sound like today, I think is impossible. It's just like no one person really knew Jimmy. If you just take his stage persona and try to judge him on that, you would be totally wrong, because off the stage he was a totally unique, loving individual, and he who loved humanity, he loved people, and that's why when they tried to play an interview with the race card on him and different things, he had some very erudite things to say about it.
He was certainly a transcending figure, but again, his issues, the same with Janis Joplin and Morrison, they're all going to be remembered for their overdose, and that's...
No, well, see, the thing is, and the truth will come to light in the next few years, you talk about Jimmy doing an overdose. Jimmy did not overdose. I emphatically tell you that, judging from it was a homicide, which will come out in the wash, and it's proven. There are people that are writing books that have done 40 years of research. I've been in touch with people, and when they say that he did an overdose, okay, for number one, I know, and I'm telling you in the world, that Jimmy did not shoot drugs. He was afraid of needles, okay? And it wasn't an overdose. And if you read the autopsy, you'll see that he asphyxiated from his own vomit and wine. Okay, that's one thing. And he had red wine poured down him while he was sleeping. And that's the basic what happened to Jimi Hendrix. And the doctor who received him in the hospital is still alive and living in Australia. And there's a guy out here doing a film who has an interview with this guy. And there's people who are writing books, and they'll tell you. And so one day the truth will come out of the wash. I'm telling you, Jimi did not die of an overdose. He was murdered. Period.
Do you have a motive, or do you have a
The motive was a $5 million. Yes, the motive was a $5 million insurance policy taken out on him by his management. He was not going to re-sign his contract. He had a project and a production company called Heavens Research Unlimited, in which he was into talent development and things of that nature. And that's what that's the direction he was going in. And they tried to stop him at every salient. To setting up these operations after Electric Lady Studio was completed.
Juma Sultan is our very special guest. This is Frank McKay, and you mentioned the management having a life insurance policy on him. Was it what did they collect on it?
Yeah, Michael Debruce collect. I mean, Michael. Yes, they collected on and he disappeared. A year later, in an alleged plane crash, and they never found the bodies.
Now, was there any investigation?
Michael Jeffries,
okay. Was there any investigation into Hendrix's death?
No, because even Scotland Yard and everyone assumed that it was a drug overdose. And once the autopsy and all the other aspects were gone, it was never truly investigated, but it is an investigation still ongoing at this point.
Yeah, I mean, murder is always open. It's always,
exactly.
There's no statute.
And I'm telling you, as far as I know, Scotland Yard, about three, four years ago, reopened the investigation on Jimi Hendrix's death.
Now, how would you prove something like that? Were the people around Jimi Hendrix when he passed away...
The principals, and if you want to talk about it, the principals was Monica Daneman, she's gone, and Eric Burden, he's still here. He could shed a lot of light on it.
I've had Eric on the show, and I didn't realize
he
was
no,
He was
not the stage manager, Eric Burden. I say the guy that was with
the Animals, right?
No. I'm telling.
It's the right. You give me the right name.
No, I'm trying to think of the name of his band. I can't really. Eric Burden. That's who it is.
Yeah, Eric Burden was with the Animals and War, the band War.
Correct.
Right, and he was
with. That's what I said. That's the same person. That's what I said. War, Eric Burden.
Now, do you
he's
think
he's still living?
Yeah, no, I know he is. He's been on the show. You know, I didn't realize that he was with. And we just kind of.
When Monica Bannerman says she discovered Jimmy unconscious, she called Eric Burton.
Huh,
and they came. I knew her too, and they came and they cleaned up. They cleaned up the place before they call the ambulance. But he could shed a great deal of light.
Now,
I don't want to go too deep on it because you can look into it yourself.
No, well, I will. I mean, it's fascinating, and it's you know, it's a huge part of history. I mean, what's your prediction? I mean, this is, you know, Eric is in his 70s.
The prediction is that the truth will come to light, and like so many other things that happens in the world, you know, all the way from the World Trade Center back. Okay, it will be probably dismissed by most people. As a conspiracy theory, and the majority of the people believe so much propaganda in the world that they will stick to he was a druggie and he OD'd. So how that's going to change the face of anything, I could not tell you.
What was the official cause of death? Was it a heroin overdose?
No, the official cause of death was asphyxiation. He was drowned.
Right, with his own vomit, he was drowned.
Well, no. The thing is that he was vomiting, yes. But the thing is that he had red wine all the way through his lungs and all the way down, and not one in his stomach, because he didn't like red wine either.
Mm.
He didn't drink red wine. But he did take sleeping pills, and he was asleep when they did it.
Mm.
When it happened. I won't say when they did it, but when it happened.
When it happened.
Whoever did.
And, I mean, it's interesting. You mentioned Michael Jeffries. Michael Jeffries, did he have other acts at the time? I mean, you imagine Hendrix was his big act.
No, Michael Jeffries was basically, yeah. He had another act because I played with him, Fat Mattress. He had Fat Mattress, which was Noel Redding's band.
Right, but he didn't have anybody the status of Hendrix.
Oh, no way. But at the same time, just like I went to Mike Jeffries' house, I'm still maybe 4 miles from there, 3 miles from where he had his location here in Woodstock. And I went there, and when I saw Jimmy in town, he said, oh, man, well, we'll just come up and jam. And when we went up there to jam, it was just him and I. It was just percussion and guitar. And subsequently, later on, I went up there to the same place and played with Fat Mattress, and I played with Noel even after that.
Was there any, and not to get off of this, we'd need a whole other interview to get into this.
Oh, okay. All right. Go
but,
ahead.
But let me ask you, was there ever any animosity between yourself and the guys, or even for that matter, Billy and Mitch Mitchell or Noel, the guys that in essence you replaced?
Okay. The only one who had some type of grievance was Mitch Mitchell, because he felt that why does Jimmy need two percussionists? And if you look at some of their interviews, you'll see that he had all these black guys around him. You know, it was some prejudicial or predilections that they would not like. And this is between the whole entity. And as far as Mike Jeffries go, he offered me a contract, which I still have in my archives, not to play with Jimmy, emphatically. You know,
was he offering money?
They offered me a contract, which was it could have been, to me, it was bogus, because it wasn't about monies at that time, because at that time I was fairly independent myself. But it was about a contract, and since they didn't offer me much money to do it, I couldn't even consider it. And I don't think they could have offered me enough money for me to consider it. I considered it as a joke, But in my archives, I'm an archivist, and I have. When you go on my website, you'll see that I have documentations all the way from 1965 when I started archiving material and things of that nature, recordings. And but I still have the contract from them. From it was called Piranha Productions, and it was just a whole bunch of. To me, it appeared like mafia soldiers that I had to deal with that were start trying to get into the music world, and they were under the banner of Michael Jeffries.
If you're just tuning in, I'll remind you that this is Frank McKay, and I have about 2 minutes left with Jumar Sultan, who is a musician extraordinaire, 50 years plus worth of music coming out of this man, and he has just done an amazing job with his career. Let me ask you, and keep in mind we have 2 minutes left. I'm going to ask you about your social media again. We'll remind everyone of how to get in touch with you. But let me ask you about about the idea that you are an archivist.
Archivist, right. I save documents, and I also record.
Let me ask you this. All right, you have all of this, and it sounds like you have this in a nice, orderly fashion. If you
I don't have all the Hendrix material in a nice orderly fashion. Is basically my jazz background, because I received for that specifically a grant from the National Endowment, and I have it all on computer. I have it all definitely organized to the extent that a certain element of it. I've just had 450 pieces that's being appraised by Columbia University because they want it for their loft jazz collection.
Well, that's my question, is what happens? And keep in mind, we have about 30 seconds left. If you get struck by lightning, right, tomorrow, and, you know, 20 years
right.
from now,
right.
who gets this? I mean, is this in safe hands?
Who would get it would be my children.
Right, okay.
My children would get it. And who would assist them? The assistant would be by Stephen Farina from Potsdam University, and also a professor who helped me. He got a grant to come live with me for 6 months to organize separate from the National Endowment. And so his name is Michael Heller. He's a professor at Harvard right now, an ethnomusicologist. And they would help my family. These guys have been tried and true over the last 8-9 years.
Oh, that's terrific.
You're very familiar.
You got invaluable, irreplaceable material there. I hope it's kept well.
We have a team. It's kept as best as I can. We have a team.
We're going to need
Warren.
Go ahead.
The same guy that did the Alan Lomax was my engineer, who transferred hundreds of hours of material. And he's out in L.A. right now. But he did the whole Alan Lomax. He worked for Wolfgang Vault. And these are people that came through. I didn't have the money to afford them, but they believed in the cause and what I was doing. So those are names that I want to mention.
Amazing work, amazing career. We need a part two and a part three if I can get you. It's been so hard to get you. We've been trying for months to get you, I think. But Jumar Sultan, it's been an honor.
I'm still a working musician, and I'm involved in various projects because I still support myself through my music. I gave up my day job a couple of years ago.
All right. Well, listen, keep making music and keep good track of that material. The archives are just invaluable. We got to cut off here. We're out of time. Jumar, thank you very much. It's been
okay. And thank you for taking your time.
Yeah, and please let's speak again real soon. Jumar Sultan, everyone, has been our special guest. We will see you next time on Breaking It Down. This is Frank McKay signing off.